With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Knepper, and today we'll be talking to Andrew Marinus to discuss his new book, Singled Out, The True Story of Glenn Burke. This is Andrew's third book. His two previous books are Games of Deception, The True Story of the First U.S. Olympic Basketball Team at the 1936 Olympics in Hitler's Germany, and Strong Inside, Perry Wallace and the Collision of Race and Sports in the South. So, Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Paul. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you on. I wonder if you could start off by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So if you want to go way back, I was born in Madison, Wisconsin, and remain a Brewers and Packers fan, even though I haven't lived there for over 40 years. We moved to the East Coast, so I grew up mostly in Washington, D.C. Family moved to Austin, Texas, where you are, when I was in high school. And it was while I was a student at Austin High that I happened to see a poster advertising a full tuition sports writing scholarship to Vanderbilt University. And I was a baseball player and the sports editor of our high school paper. And so I applied for that scholarship and had never been to Nashville or really even heard of Vanderbilt before. But I was lucky and I won that scholarship. And so that's why I moved to Nashville, which is where I am today. And it was as a student at Vanderbilt that I first learned the story of Perry Wallace. Who you mentioned is the subject of my first book. He was the first black basketball player in the SEC. And it took the school 20 years to invite him back to campus to honor him for being the Jackie Robinson of the SEC. And it just happened to be when I was a student at Vanderbilt that that happened, that he came back. And so I learned about him reading about articles in the paper about this figure coming back to campus and wrote a paper about him for a black history course. And enjoyed that, but didn't think about writing a book. You know, I graduated in 92. I worked as the publicist for the Vanderbilt basketball team until 97. Moved on to the Tampa Bay Rays when they came along in 98 as the media relations manager. And then moved back to Nashville and was with a PR firm here for almost 20 years. And it was during that period that I really sort of missed writing about sports, what had been an interest of mine since I was 13 years old, writing my own little sports magazine as a middle schooler. And so I came back to that story of Perry Wallace that I felt had been the most interesting thing that I did as a student in college. And it took me 8 years to write that first book, but I loved it. And it really sort of changed the course of my life from that point forward, where I left the agency. I've come back to Vanderbilt, working in the athletic department here. Being on a college campus is a supportive environment for continuing to write books. And so I've been able to carve out a way to work on special projects here in the athletic department, which mostly involve research and writing and social justice projects here, which are all up my alley, you know, and then continue to write these books. I've got a great wife, Allison. We have a fourth grader, Eliza, and a first grader, Charlie, and brainwashing them to be fans of the Brewers and the Packers too. So everything's pretty good right now.
I know how that brainwashing goes. I have a 5-year old that I'm starting him. He's been watching a lot of Knick games with me. Okay. So it's, yeah, you got to start him young.
Oh yeah. My son woke up this morning, you know, the Brewers are on the West Coast and he didn't know the score of the Padres game last night. I told him the Brewers won. It was as if they had won the World Series. Like, just so every game is life and death to this kid right now, which is fun to see. I know I was that way as a kid too.
Yeah. So as you document in the book of, you know, this was, Glenn Burke was the first openly gay, baseball player. And as I mentioned to you, you know, before we came on air that, I really like the way you use Burke's life to, as a lens into greater social issues, you know, homophobia and racism and HIV AIDS and the crack epidemic and on and on. I mean, you really got into a lot of stuff in there, and I know that's something that you've done in all your books. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, your desire to kind of weld, you know, sports and social issues.
Yeah. You know, I'm at one level, I'm just a regular sports fan, like anybody, that wins and losses matter and statistics and, you know, having favorite players and everything. But I think what makes sports interesting from an author standpoint is putting the stories of these athletes or teams into the context of the world that they existed in, you know, and what are the bigger stories that sports can help illustrate. One thing for me is I think sports are accessible, you know, to a lot of people. It doesn't matter how old you are or what gender you are or what your income is, what political party even, like, people pay attention to sports, right? All sorts of people pay attention. And I don't think it's intimidating to pick up a book with a basketball player on the cover or a baseball player on the cover. And so that, as an author, that's sort of getting past the first hurdle, is that, like, this book can be for typically for anybody, pretty much. Especially for me, my books are considered young adult books, you know, that teenagers are a big market for my books. And I think that they are interested in, even more so than adults in some cases, the social issues that are going around them today, you know, and willing to explore those issues and eager to talk about them. And all of my books I consider just as much for adults too, but a lot of my speaking is in high schools and in colleges for that matter, talking about these issues. And with Glenn's story, the ability to write about baseball, my favorite sport, during primarily the 1970s, which I was born in 1970. So that's sort of my first decade of consciousness as a sports fan. And then to tell his story in a bigger context of a gay rights movement and the backlash to that movement, I thought would make just a fascinating thing to research and an enjoyable thing to write about, even though a lot of aspects of his life are not fun. But it, I mean, in terms of it, having good material to use and important stories to tell, it was all there. And then, like you said, towards the end of his life, he's in San Francisco before the arrival of HIV AIDS and talks about, you know, sort of finally finding some comfort and happiness. And then how quickly that ends because of what is happening in his, not just in the world, but in his neighborhood, on his blocks, you know, people on his softball teams dying of this new disease. They don't know what's causing it. And so there's a whole generation of kids now that really don't even know much about that era. And I thought this would be an interesting way to present that to them. So some people want to say sports and politics should be kept separate. You know, I don't think they've ever been separate. I mean, go back to the 30s with my book, Games of Deception, on that Olympic basketball team. Olympics, period, are an example of sports and politics mixing, but no greater example than the Nazis hosting the Olympics. So, you know, I try to point out certain hypocrisies in my books also. And there were plenty of them to point out in Glenn Burke's story too.
Sure. Yeah. I never bought into that nonsense that sports and politics don't mix. I mean, the same people saying that are the same people who are furious that people don't stand for the national anthem sure. before baseball games, right?
Exactly.
Football games. You know, you're a little bit older than I am, Andrew, but we're the same generation. And so a lot of this really brought me back to, you know, certainly, I mean, the HIV AIDS, I don't think people can understand how enormous and terrifying that was for children our age, you know, when we were coming up. And you know, as far as Glenn goes, his story is tragic. I mean, it's a tragic story. And yet at the same time, I found myself encouraged because you forget. I mean, I remember, but, you know, you forget, you know, I grew up in a pretty liberal town, and There wasn't one openly gay person in my high school. I didn't know one openly gay person in my community. And, you know, this is the 1990s we're talking about. This not that long ago. You know, there weren't any or very few gay role models, gay characters on television. You know, I mean, Andrew, when you and I were kids, the idea that gay people would be allowed to get married was unthinkable. There wasn't even a movement towards that at that time. It was like that would have sounded ludicrous to us. So I was encouraged, as tragic as the story was, I was encouraged. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what life was like for gay people in the late 70s and into the 80s for our younger listeners who weren't around then.
Yeah, and you've described it well. I mean, there's so many things that we see and in some cases take for granted now about how people are treated or opportunities that people have that did not exist then. At the same time, just quickly to talk about today before we go back to then, I mean, just like in so many other areas of life right now, there's incredible polarization on a lot of these issues. So even at the same time that there have been these cultural gains that we can be proud of, there are plenty of legislation. I live in Tennessee, you know, which is a really ugly example of it, that's anti-LGBTQ, anti-transgender, you know, and so it's not like we're completely out of the woods on these things yet. But back then, like you said, there weren't even gay characters on TV. The idea of openly gay politicians was very rare. Harvey Milk in San Francisco was one of the first examples of that. And that's at the same time that Glenn is coming up and living in San Francisco. You had tremendous backlash to what was a gay rights movement in the 70s too. And Glenn's story fits really neatly into that also. When he's in spring training in Florida, in Vero Beach where Dodgertown was, Anita Bryant's down in Miami leading a crusade against an ordinance that protected gay workers in their jobs in Miami. When he's coming up with the Dodgers, there's proposed legislation in the state of California, the Briggs Initiative, it was called, that would have allowed schools to fire gay teachers or any other employees of the schools that even supported those gay teachers. You know, and so that's the environment Glenn's living in. The idea that there would be a gay professional athlete was also sort of just, you know, beyond imagination to a lot of people. The Advocate magazine, gay magazine, sent out a letter to Major League Baseball teams asking to discuss just the issue of gay men in Major League Baseball. And the Minnesota Twins PR director wrote back this scathing letter. This wasn't his private opinion, but this public letter that he sent back to the magazine saying that, you know, that it was just almost obscene that they would even ask that question in this area, he said, of total manhood, you know. Meanwhile, there are gay players in the game, of course, and there always had been. But Glenn was concerned, and rightly so, that if the word got out about his sexuality, that could spell the end of his career. And he's a little bit inconsistent or ambivalent in the way that he dealt with that. On the one hand, he knew it could spell the end of his career. On the other hand, he was a proud person that wasn't going to completely hide it, who he was. And so he was going to, gay bars during the season while his teammates were going to straight bars. You know, in the off season, he was living in the Castro district of San Francisco, not hiding who he was. But he also had this really sort of it's really sad to think about, you know, as he's coming up through the minor leagues, he's not sure what's the best approach going to be. On one hand, he says, maybe I need to hit, you know, over 300 and steal 100 bases, you know, and then if I'm really good, no one's going to be able to say anything to me, even if they figure it out. Then he has this feeling, well, maybe that's the wrong approach. Maybe I just need to be mediocre, you know, and if I'm not attracting a lot of attention, the spotlight will be off me. I can be a little bit more anonymous as a player. Maybe that's the best approach. And like, what other, young rookie is thinking, well, maybe the best approach for me is to be mediocre, you know? And it really shows you what homophobia does to people and not allowing them to be sort of become their best selves. And that we all lose from that when people even have this sort of self-limitation that they're putting on themselves, not to be their full authentic selves.
Yeah, that's certainly, there are a number of tragic aspects to his story, and that is certainly at the forefront. You know, it's heartbreaking that he didn't feel free to be himself and live the life that he wanted to live and love who he wanted to love openly. It seemed particularly tragic. That's always tragic. It seemed particularly tragic with him because he was, you really describe him as such an effervescent personality. The people loved him all in the locker room and, you know, in the clubhouse and in the bars. And it seemed everyone who came in contact to, I was really struck that a couple of the veterans on the Dodgers team were crying in the clubhouse after he was traded. And, you know, it really jumped out at me. I was like, wait a minute, he'd only been with the team for a year and a half. You know, this wasn't like Don Drysdale was traded, Sandy Koufax cried, you know, where they had spent their whole careers together. This was after a short time. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Glenn's personality and how he affected people.
Yeah, that's a great point too. And yeah, he was beloved. He was one of those people that was charismatic. He was funny. He loved to imitate like Richard Pryor back in those days. Players all said he was the best dancer on the team. And this is during the disco era when they were going out to discos a lot. Going back to high school, he was a popular kid. He was a great basketball player, great baseball player. He was sort of a protector that looked out for the kids that weren't as popular. You know, I think that says a lot about him too. On the playground, he would pick the kids that nobody else would pick to be on his team, and he'd still win, you know. So, and then, like you said, that was probably one of the biggest surprises to me, pleasant surprise. It was reading about when Glenn was traded from the Dodgers and interviewing Dusty Baker and Davey Lopes and getting a sense of just how devastating that was. Like you said, he'd only been there a year and a half. He was a fourth outfielder on a veteran team with plenty of great players. You think back to those Dodgers teams of the 70s, Glenn Burke's name typically is not one that comes first to mind. And yet he was the glue of that clubhouse. He was the one that kept things light, kept things loose, got along with all the players. And, you know, baseball clubhouses are notorious for having cliques and, you know, the black players over here, the white players over here, the Latino players over here. But Glenn was somebody that they all loved, from Steve Garvey and Don Sutton to Davey Lopes and Dusty Baker. And so when he was traded, it was Garvey and Sutton that were sitting at their lockers crying. And Dusty Baker and Davey Lopes, who confronted Al Campanis, the general manager, talked to the team trainer, tried to get them to admit that the reason Glenn was traded was because he was gay, you know, and they were really pissed off about this. And I just think that that's a great example of what a charismatic, popular person this must have been, that he's the one that they're crying about. And the amazing thing that, you know, he had that type of personality, even though he was constantly looking over his shoulder and kind of feeling a lack of support from people, you know, explicitly feeling a lack of support from Campanis, who had offered him $75,000 in the previous offseason to get married to cover up the fact that he was gay. And so here's someone that had plenty of reason to sort of retreat into themselves, you know, and yet he was so outgoing. And that does make it extra tragic towards the end of his life, when he has been someone that has given so much to other people, that he ends up living homeless on the streets of San Francisco and is kind of abandoned by the world. It's particularly heartbreaking.
So you mentioned Campanis and of course, some of his teammates. Were there instances where teammates were openly hostile towards him, either with the Dodgers or the A's, because he was homosexual?
Yeah, I guess you could call it sort of an open secret. Like, he had never publicly come out as gay as a player. He didn't have a press conference. It wasn't until 1982, when he had been out of baseball for 2 years, that Inside Sports ran a big article about him, and he went on the Today Show and really sort of came out to the world. But as he's working his way up through the minor leagues, players are starting to kind of figure it out. You know, Glenn occasionally will introduce boyfriends of his to close friends on the team. They notice that he's making excuses not to go out after games, saying he had to call his mom or go shopping, and it's 11:30 at night, you know, and the guys are like, this doesn't quite make sense. For the most part, his teammates were incredibly supportive, or because Glenn was so big and imposing physically that they weren't going to make it an issue because they knew they would have gotten the crap beat out of them by Glenn Burke if they did. Particularly with the Dodgers, he was supporting. He starts to see it a little bit more with the Oakland A's when he's traded there. These are players that hadn't come up through the minor leagues with him. They didn't really know Glenn as well. They had heard some whispers about him. And so I think the pockets of support were much smaller with the A's. It was more the manager, Billy Martin, that came out and said he wasn't going to let Glenn contaminate his team. He wasn't going to have – he introduces Glenn as F-word, you know, to his teammates. When Glenn is sent down to AAA by Billy Martin in 1980, I talked to Shooty Babbitt, who was one of his teammates, and he said that there was a lot of tension in the clubhouse with players not wanting to be near Glenn. But they didn't really force the issue with him because Glenn had 17-inch biceps. He was the strongest guy on the team. Fred Clair, the later general manager of the – or president of the Dodgers, said, think of like Yasiel Puig. That's the kind of body that Glenn had. So he was very physically impressive and imposing. And Shooty Babbitt was really honest and a little vulnerable about the dynamic that that created. First of all, you weren't going to approach Glenn because you knew that he was stronger than you were, period. But he also admitted that it would be to men of that era, to baseball players of that era, if you knew Glenn was gay and you got beat up by him, that would be sort of the ultimate blow to your own sense of masculinity, you know? And so Shooty was willing to express that opinion. He also told a story about at a game they were playing in Hawaii in AAA where the catcher kept bouncing the ball down to second base. Shooty was playing second, and he was pissed off that the catcher couldn't get the ball to him on good throws on stolen bases or, you know, warming up between innings. And he confronts him about it in the dugout, and they start fighting, and Glenn's the one that breaks up the fight and says, you know, we're teammates. We're all black men on this team. We're not going to be fighting each other. And Shooty Babbitt admitted to me that moment he wasn't quite sure, like, should I go ahead and get beat up by the catcher so I don't owe Glenn something sexually for protecting me? You know, and later he said how ridiculous that was. But at the time, that was his thought. And I think that really gives you an insight into the way that people were treating or maybe not even, you know, what they were saying to Glenn, but the way they were acting around him and the sense of the lack of support, the lack of camaraderie that was surrounding him.
Right. Yeah. And I you point out at some point in the book, kind of the irony that of, you know, here, these homophobic guys who are all showering together and walking around the locker room naked together.
And not,
I don't, it's just, you know, some of the, you know, the ideas and the stereotypes were just so outrageous.
Yeah, and the other one I thought was outrageous is people typically, even today, they'll say like a player who speaks up on social issues or a gay player would be a quote-unquote distraction to a team, you know. And Glenn wasn't a distraction. He was the most loved player on the team. And Tommy Lasorda was inviting Don Rickles and Frank Sinatra into the clubhouse before games. I mean, he was inviting distractions. Charlie Finley was wacko, you know, owning the Oakland A's. There were plenty of distractions around the A's. Glenn wasn't the distraction. He was a consummate, you know, team player on these teams.
Right. I mean, you mentioned he could have beaten up just about anybody on the field, and he had a bit of a temper. It sounds like, you know, there was an edge to him. Do you think that was all the frustration of being gay and having to kind of hide his lifestyle and the backlash he received about that? Or was there more to that? Was there, you know, some other demons in him? I mean, even just, you know, I don't know how related this is, but after baseball, you know, he had a very difficult time kind of finding his way in society and figuring out, a career path and just how to move forward in a healthy, functional way in society. But how much of that was, you know, the rejection for being gay and or were there other things at play?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I can't answer it with 100% certainty. I think that, yes, I think that he did have a temper. There was always sort of an edge to Glenn. Some of his minor league teammates said they never knew which Glenn was going to show up. You know, on one hand, he was the most popular player on the team, his funniest player on the team. But on the other hand, he could snap pretty quickly, fight with his own teammates on the bus sometimes. You know, there's a case where someone took one of his beers and he was upset about that. He wasn't the type that was going to just lay down to authority either. You know, he would talk back to his managers. And I think that as an armchair psychiatrist, like, you could probably say that, well, he had these underlying tensions, you know, in his life. And then that maybe was sometimes spilled over, you know, especially on the field or in that environment of baseball. I think that there was some history in his family also of, alcohol abuse, of domestic violence. And so to what degree that shaped Glenn, I don't know, but it's possible. He was growing up in the Bay Area where there were, at the time, the Black Panthers were forming, and there was incredible racism in that community and police violence, and that surrounded him. When he's in high school at Cal Berkeley, you know, there are protests against the Vietnam War and against the free speech restrictions on campus. And his high school is a couple blocks from that. And he's seeing the protests that are taking place out on the street in front of his high school. And so the idea of, you know, speaking his mind and being a proud African-American person, proud of himself and not backing down from who he was, I think that was all a part of who Glenn was. And sometimes he had different ways of expressing that. Not putting up with any BS was a big part of who Glenn was, I think, regardless of whether he had the underlying sexuality tensions that were present in his life as well.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Right. And, you know, I mean, as we touched on, it was so difficult in many ways to be a gay person at that time, period. That's probably multiplied by 1,000 in the arena of professional sports. Was it significantly different or more challenging to be a gay African American at that time?
Yeah, I would say so, because in every aspect of life, it was more difficult to be African American, you know, in this country, always is. And one thing that was interesting about Glenn's experience was, at that time in Major League Baseball, there were probably more Black players in MLB than there are now, certainly percentage-wise, fewer teams. But, you know, on his team, he had Dusty Baker, he had Reggie Smith, he had Davey Lopes. There were Lee Lacy, friends of his. Even across teams, Dusty Baker talked about how the Black guys on different teams would get together for lunch before games, you know, especially coming up through the minor leagues. They would tell each other, look, in this town, these are the safe bars to go to if they're playing in the South or the Midwest, where there could be a lot of hostilities. And so there was a pretty good network amongst all the gay players, Black players in Major League Baseball at that time. And that could have been a source of support for Glenn, but he even wasn't really even fully able to take advantage of that either. Because if guys are getting together and talking about what's on their mind and what are the issues they're facing, Glenn wasn't comfortable, you know, sharing everything about himself. And if they wanted to go out to a club on an off day or after a game or something, he didn't want to go to the same bars that they were going to. So even that support network that could have been there as a Black player in the game at the time, he wasn't able to take advantage of. And so that makes it even, you know, another level of difficulty that Glenn had to overcome.
How great, I guess it's a two-part question. How great of an athlete was Glenn, and how good of a baseball player in particular was Glenn? I mean, there's a quote in the book from, I forget his name, but one of the Dodger coaches who said this guy could be the next Willie Mays, basically. Yeah. I mean, was he, how good of a player was he?
Right. Oh, well, he was a fantastic athlete. He was a great basketball player. Until his dying day, he actually felt like he was a better basketball player than than baseball player. As a senior, he led his team to undefeated high school championship in Northern California. He played college basketball as he was working his way up through the minor leagues. He was one of the first athletes when the NCAA changed its rules to allow pro athletes in one sport to play collegiately in another. He's in the Dodger minor league system, and he enrolls at Nevada Reno and scores over 30 points in his first game, you know, and he hasn't, he's just come off the baseball field. He was only around 6 feet tall, but he could touch the top of the backboard. As I mentioned, he was always the strongest player on teams that he played on. And so, and even his identity, first and foremost, he just considered himself an athlete more than anything. Rupert Jones, the former major leaguer who also had gone to Berkeley High School, told me that Glenn was the best athlete he's ever seen. Junior Gilliams, the coach you're talking about with the Dodgers, who had played, you know, with Jackie Robinson and been part of the Dodgers forever. And he said that Glenn had the potential to be the next Willie Mays. As he's coming up through the minor leagues, he hit over 300 five times. He set stolen base records in two different leagues in the minor leagues. And so he was a prospect that the Dodgers really thought had all the potential in the world. And we have seen players not live up to that potential that's been put on them. Like sometimes that's the worst tag, is to get told that you have a lot of potential. And so you don't know why Glenn didn't, you know, become a major league all-star. What you do know is that when the Dodgers found out that he was gay, even though he had started game one of the 77 World Series and started two games in the 77 NLCS against the Phillies, they didn't want him on the team anymore. And you do know that when he gets to the Oakland A's, Billy Martin doesn't want him on the team. And so, you know, he didn't really have a chance to become the major league player that he could have been. The evidence is there that he wasn't supported.
Yeah. Who would have imagined that Billy Martin was an asshole?
I just think, when I think of Billy Martin, I think of it on the field arguing, you know, or getting fired by a George Steinbrenner. And I asked Mike Norris, you know, the A's pitcher, Mike Norris, that Glenn was teammates with, if he felt there was any, and you asked about this in a previous question about just racism in the game. And I said, was Billy Martin racist? And he said, no. You know, the black players liked Billy Martin. They liked playing for him. He was supportive. There were a lot of black players on the A's at that time. And so he didn't think that race had any specific things to do with Billy's, hatred towards Glenn, which is not really a feather in his cap. I mean, so that says it was 100% homophobia.
Yeah. Well, Billy had, I grew up a Yankee fan, so I was very familiar with Billy, and Billy had a real inferiority complex and was always trying to prove his manhood.
Yes.
And so it's not surprising that, you know, given the perceptions at the time, that he would be extremely homophobic.
Yeah, right. You know, he had gone to the same high school as Glenn. They were both from Berkeley High. Glenn, some ways, was always trying to prove his manhood also, you know, and when Billy became manager of the A's, Glenn initially thought it was going to be a good thing, that they were both kind of hometown guys from Berkeley. They were both sort of scrappy fighter types. But of course it didn't work out the way Glenn had hoped.
Yeah. So of course Glenn is kind of, as you describe in the book, you know, he basically run out of the game. I think you said it was 1982, a few years after he left the game, he decided to come out publicly, went on television. There was a big news article on it, all that. And to Glenn's surprise, and to my surprise as a reader, the story kind of fell flat. It wasn't nearly as big a news as you would think it would be back, given the stereotypes of the day and the belief that there were no gay professional athletes. So I guess my question is, why do you think it wasn't a bigger story? Is it just that he wasn't a big name, that he was no longer active? You know, if Hank Aaron or Willie Mays came out as gay, I'm sure it would be a much bigger story. But is it that simple, or was there more to it?
Yeah, it was really surprising to me too. And I mean, I guess in some way, like, none of us should be surprised, because who's ever heard of Glenn Burke? I mean, most people have not heard of him. So if it had been a bigger story at the time, I think we all, as baseball fans especially, would know the story, or feel like we knew the story more. But yeah, he comes out in 82 with Bryant Gumbel on the Today Show. It wasn't a particularly hyped interview. You know, it just took place in the middle of the show. Can you imagine now if a Major League Baseball player, 2 years removed from the game, from the Dodgers, you know, a big market was going to come out on the Today Show. Like, we'd be seeing ads about that for weeks before it happened, yeah. Right? It'd be all over social media. It's not a cover story, but it's a headline on the cover of Inside Sports magazine that same month about the gay Dodger. It's a big article. Glenn is actually hopeful that this media coverage will give him another chance in the major leagues, which doesn't maybe not the most intuitive thing you'd think, like that's his expectation. But his hope is that when people see that he was run out of the game due to homophobia, not that he wasn't good enough to last, that a major league team will take a chance on him again, you know, and that doesn't happen. He's hopeful even to make some money. As you mentioned earlier, he didn't really have a plan post-baseball, and his baseball career was abruptly ended. And so he's sort of a little floundering as he's living a regular life again, you know, and needs the money from this article. His partner at that time, Michael Smith, on again, off again partner, was the one who wrote it. And so Glenn thought he was going to share the money from Inside Sports with him, and he never saw any of that money. So all of his expectations for this coming out didn't pan out the way he had hoped. And I think that few of the factors, like you mentioned, he wasn't a household name. So that I think that went into it. He wasn't an active player anymore. So I think that was a part of it. I also think that in the sports media, there weren't a whole lot of journalists that were that interested in writing about gay athletes in sports. You know, if that's sort of like who would be propping up this story is the American sports media. It wasn't an issue that they really touched back then. The two organizations that he had come through, the Dodgers and the A's, you didn't have sort of their platforms pushing the story either. And then I think the big factor was that if the American media was covering a story related to gay men at that time, this is right when HIV/AIDS is coming along. And so his story was buried by all of the attention that was given to that. And so it really is the beginning of a tragic cycle in Glenn's life. You know, he's not sure what he's going to do after baseball. He's hopeful that this media coverage might give him a second chance. That doesn't come. He has this brief window in the Castro before HIV where he's living the life, at least in some ways, that he imagined or had hoped for. He's playing softball. He's a star on the gay softball circuit in San Francisco. But then he's hit by a car and his legs are broken. And so his identity as an athlete is over, essentially, at that point. Had he been introduced to cocaine as a Major League Baseball player coming along right at the time that it's, you know, coming along in Major League clubhouses. And because of the pain of his injury, I think because of the mental anguish he's going through of being denied his career, he turns to drugs as a coping mechanism. And that, as you might imagine, leads to other problems. And really, you don't see many happy moments in Glenn's life after that.
Yeah, and of course, that kind of coincided with the explosion of crack,
yes.
You know, the crack epidemic. And you know, reading it, it's like there were several deaths in his life, you know, the death of his baseball career, then the death of his even, you know,
his effervescence,
athletic, you know, his effervescence, his athletic career. And then, of course, his ultimate, you know, death. You know, you touched on AIDS, HIV AIDS a little bit and. You know, we're talking about before just some of the things that people, younger generations, just I think can't relate to, have no idea what it was like back then. And that was HIV/AIDS. And again, going back to my childhood, I know it was something that was drilled into our heads. You know, I remember in middle school and high school, there were constantly assemblies and people talking to us about being protected in HIV/AIDS and it'll kill you. And it was terrifying. I mean, I wasn't even sexually active or a drug user, and I was terrified.
Right, right. Yeah, you know? I agree. Same with me.
Yeah. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, the kind of the onset of the HIV/AIDS epidemic and what that was like.
Yeah, well, Glenn sees that in San Francisco as he's living there in the off season. Well, I shouldn't say the off season. This is after he's out of baseball, but playing softball. And his softball teammates start to become sick There's posters on the wall of the pharmacy about these purple lesions on people's feet. And this, they called it a gay cancer at first. People weren't sure what it was. There's misinformation in the media in the Castro about how it spread, how to protect yourself. And so it's really scary to imagine your friends dying, but then also just the regular people you see in the neighborhood. The bus driver, you know, is not there anymore. The person that used to work at the grocery store, not there anymore. I talked to a person who owned a bed and breakfast, essentially, that was, you know, very close with Glenn, and said that people were coming out and sort of having their final vacations, you know, knowing that they were about to die. Travel agents scheduling trips for people for like their last hurrah. And this neighborhood of the Castro that had been so full of life, all of a sudden, you know, is this hellscape of death. And that's the environment that Glenn, he's gone from starting in center field at Yankee Stadium in the World Series now to living in the Castro homeless and dying of AIDS. And the inhumanity of people, like you said, like people who had no reason necessarily to fear AIDS, treating anyone who happened to be gay as an outcast. You know, there are examples of gay men wanting to go home and visit their family for Thanksgiving or Christmas, and, you know, the parents not letting him in the house, fumigating the house after they left. A gay man flying home to Phoenix to die at his parents' house, and the pilot trying to kick him off the plane. No one's serving him on the plane. You know, when he dies, the funeral home won't even touch his body. They bury it in plastic and set it on fire. You know, just incredible acts of fear and inhumanity and outcasting. And you also saw a presidential administration not wanting to deal with it, or refusing to deal with it because of who was affected. You know, and you can make some parallels to the way COVID was treated when Trump administration realized it was a lot of Black and brown people that were dying of COVID and sort of a lack of action on it. Well, that was happening with the Reagan administration when it was gay men that were dying of AIDS, and you didn't see anything happening. And you saw political commentators saying, you know, that they deserved it to die. And so that was the environment that Glenn was living and dying in.
Yeah, I was thinking of COVID a little bit as you were talking, you know, in terms of, I mean, some of it obviously was just pure hatred and inhumane and all that. And some of it was, I don't know if you'd say legitimate fear, but, you know, if you think back to the early stages of COVID, when we didn't understand it, and we just knew people were getting sick and dying, you were scared.
Yes.
And rightfully so. And early on, when there was as much information, and early in the AIDS, you know, crisis, we didn't have a great deal of information about how it was spread and so forth. And so there was a somewhat legitimate fear. Now, people went way too far with that, of course.
Right.
But it was there was really an aura of fear.
Yes. And
one thing I want to touch on, I really appreciated in the book that you, because it was considered a gay disease, and for many of us, the thing that woke us up was Magic Johnson, of course.
Right.
For many, you know, for a long time, it was very much considered a gay disease. And I appreciated that in the book, you talked a little bit about why it spread so rampantly in the gay community and why gay people seem to be more inclined to get it. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, because I think it's important.
Yeah, well, I thought it was important to say that there's nothing inherent about being gay that, like, gives you AIDS or something like that, you know, which I think a lot of people
at that
time. Punished
by God, yeah.
Right, yeah. And there was some sentiment or propaganda around that back then. It just so happened that certain safe sex practices that maybe weren't being followed, or like, who were the first people to get AIDS? It's going to spread in that community. And so I thought it was important to point that out, especially for younger readers reading the book. Last thing I wanted to do was to stereotype a group of people in this book. And yeah, you know, these were the people that were being affected by the disease at first. And so to show almost a definition of what HIV was and how it is spread, I thought was an important thing to put in the book, especially knowing that younger readers are picking up this book.
Right. And I, you know, I even learned a lot. I didn't know it spread more easily through anal sex. I didn't necessarily think, well, right, gay people didn't need to wear condoms because they didn't have to worry about getting pregnant. And that, you know, just, I mean, simple, you would argue, common sense things that it just never really gave much thought to. What do you think Glenn would think about your book?
Great question. I hope he would like it. You know, he did want his story told. As he was dying, he sat down with Eric Sherman, a New York sports writer, and they collaborated on an autobiography that came out, self-published book in 95 when Glenn was dying. And so I know that he wanted his story out there. That was important to him, even as he's in incredible pain, to give these interviews to Eric. I think that he hoped that his experience would make it easier for gay players in the future, which you could say there's a pretty mixed record on that. I mean, the doors that he opened, there haven't been a whole lot of people walking through them, not through any fault of their own, but I think just because of the lingering homophobia, especially in men's professional sports, even collegiate sports in this country. But, you know, I've heard from some gay baseball players who have called me or emailed me since this book came out, and, you know, people I didn't know before, and they're encouraged by the story, just the fact that it's out there, and, you know, and people are talking about it again. And they
are
all
these, are these, I'm sorry to interrupt, are these current players?
Current players, not in the major leagues, minor league players, and who know of major league players and umpires that they're hopeful will come out. And so I think Glenn would be, happy that the conversation is happening again. The one thing, I don't know that he would have this attitude, but the subject of one of my other books had this attitude, Perry Wallace, who was the basketball pioneer. And when he was pioneering, he was hated by a lot of people and misunderstood by a lot of people, intentionally misunderstood by a lot of people who didn't want to hear what he had to say about the racism that he was experiencing. Later in his life, those same communities were embracing him, you know, and welcoming him back to Nashville or to Vanderbilt and listening to what he had to say. And, you know, in some ways that's great. In other ways, you wonder, is it really authentic here? Where were these people when you needed them? And but what he said was reconciliation without the truth is just acting. And a lot of times organizations, teams, universities want to have these moments of reconciliation, you know, at least the photo op to have this person back and everyone's smiling. And he said, if they haven't really dealt with the truth of what the situation was in the first place, then it's just for show. You know, it's false. It's just acting. If the truth is present, then those can be really powerful moments. And so he felt like the truth was present when he was invited back, you know, later in his life. I'm hoping that Glenn would feel like, you know, his name is out there now. There's been, there was a middle grade fiction book called A High Five for Glenn Burke that came out a couple of years ago. There's my book, MLB through Billy Bean, and some of the work they're doing is, you know, getting Glenn's name back out there, celebrating Pride Month, that sort of thing. And so if Glenn's name is going to kind of come back, if people are going to talk about the history that he made as the first openly gay player and the inventor of the high five, then I think it's important that it's not just treated as those two lines of trivia, you know, but let's really learn what his experience was like so that we can make it easier for those gay ball players that are coming up through the minor leagues or are already in the major leagues now and not repeat the same mistakes, you know? And so I think that I think he would have that same sort of attitude because Glenn was always real, you know, he didn't shy away from things. And so I think in that respect, he would be happy there's a book that tells his real story.
All right. I have one last question for you, Angie. I'll get you out of here with taking enough of your time, but let me just say again, the name of Andrew's book is Singled Out, The True Story of Glenn Burke. And yeah, we didn't even get into the whole high five thing. I mean, that was so cool and so kind of, you know, emblematic of his effervescence. I keep using that word, but I think it really applies just the enthusiasm that he brought to the game. It's such a cool, lasting legacy, the high five. I think ESPN did a 30 for 30 short.
Yes, they did.
Yeah. So anyway, I love this book. I told you before, Andrew, it's Glenn's story is fascinating and but it's so much more than a sports book. It's, you know, it just touches on so many issues, you know, so many social issues. And so if you're interested in homosexuality or the disco era. You know, I mean, that was all that was fun to kind of go through just the whole disco lifestyle.
Yeah.
And, you know, racism and HIV AIDS and drug use and the lifestyle and the Castro in the late 70s is fascinating, all that stuff. So I definitely recommend Andrew's book. One last question I have for you, Andrew. I like to ask all my guests, what is your all-time favorite sports book?
Ooh, great question. It's pretty much all I read.
me
so
too.
I think I need to mention two because my dad wrote them. So I can't get out of here.
I read the Clemente book is just marvelous, and I read his book about the Rome Olympics too, which was great. But go ahead.
Really three. I mean, I would say both of the autobiography of Clemente, a book about the Rome Olympics, and then a biography of Vince Lombardi, also called When Pride Still Mattered, and I'm a Packers fan, so I love that book. I mean, I'm a crazy kid. When I was growing up, I read Packer Report and What's Brewing, these little newsletters about them. So, I mean, I've always been reading about sports. I think my dad had me read You Know Me, Al, which is written by like Ring Lardner in the 1920s, probably was one of the first books that I read. I like John Feinstein's books a lot, and that whole style of, you know, spending a year with a team or with a player or on the PGA Tour. I love those types of books. I like Howard Bryant's books, more current, you know, about race and social justice.
Yeah, the Heritage sport. Was really good.
Yeah, Heritage, really good book. I feel like I'm forgetting lots of great books.
I know, there are so many.
It's any sports nonfiction that's a narrative nonfiction that really takes you there behind the scenes are my favorite types of books. And I'm working on a book right now on my first related to women's sports. It'll come out late next year on the first women's U.S. Olympic basketball team, which played at the 1976 Olympics in Montreal.
Wow.
I've been reading a lot of good books about history of women's basketball, the women's rights movement of the 1970s. So in some ways it'll be a little similar to this book on Glenn, taking place roughly the same time period.
Well, great. I look forward to reading that one too.
Thank you.
All right, Andrew. Well, thanks again for coming on. This was a lot of fun and the book was great. So best of luck with it.
Thanks, Paul. It was a lot of fun. It was a great interview and I appreciate you having this show. You know, a platform for authors to talk about their books is very, it's appreciated because there are fewer and fewer, it seems like, outlets to learn about books. You know, book reviews have pretty much disappeared. A lot of the book magazines and publications don't take sports books seriously, which is a pet peeve of mine. You know, I don't even think that there's a sports category in the bestseller list anymore like there used to be. So more power to you, Paul. Thank you for what you do.
Oh, thank you. Okay, take care, Andrew.
All right, you too. Take care.